Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And today I am very happy to say we have Mark Alizart on the show, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Dogs. One of the things I really like about this book is the telegraphicness, did I just make that word up, of the title. This book is about dogs. So many times you see books and you don't exactly know what they are about, having read the title. But this one's about dogs. And Mark and I have already had an interesting email exchange about dogs. There's a beautiful Weimaraner on the cover of the book, and I hope we get to talk about that as well. I've had dogs myself. I did when I was a kid. I haven't had one for a long time, but I enjoyed them very much. And I also enjoyed reading Mark's terrific book. It's just out from Polity Press, so I encourage you to go out and get a copy of it. But let me turn directly to Mark. Mark, thank you for being on the show.
Hi, Marshall. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so, I'm a philosopher. I was trained as a philosopher anyways, although I'm interested in lots of other things. I'm not a teacher, actually. I write books, but for a living, I used to work in contemporary art in the Centre Pompidou in Paris, where I live, and at the Palais de Tokyo, at the Ministry of Culture, and now I'm a full-time writer right now, and that's about most, yeah, what I could say.
Well, that's a lot. that's a lot, and we discussed earlier in the pre-interview how you get to go have a croissant every morning around the corner in Paris. I was going to say, you dog, you. I don't get to do that where I live. So anyway, tell us why you wrote the book Dogs.
Actually, it's really a coincidence because I never thought that as a philosopher I would write a book on dogs at any time. I mean, it's not why I got into philosophy. I got into philosophy because of astrophysics and computer science and quantum mechanics and the profound desire to understand the world in a very metaphysical way. I mean, like, you can imagine 18 years old guy going into philosophy, and it actually fell on it fell upon me after I adopted a dog, which was my first dog. Well, not exactly my first dog. It's my grandfather used to have a dog, but my first personal dog, and that was about 3 or 4 years ago, and unfortunately he died very very young. And I the sorrow that it brought to me was very profound, deep, and lasted a very long time. And after a year of mourning, I actually thought I had to do something about it. I had to overcome this melancholy, and that meant understanding the meaning of what we had lived together. And it didn't really start like a book about, like, I didn't think about what's the philosophy of dogs, but I just wanted to write this kind of letter to my dog and impressions of the life we had together. And also, I guess I felt there's something wrong with the way dogs are treated and the way I couldn't relate to any picture, image, description of a dog in culture, in popular culture, or even in high culture. I mean, there's no Moby Dick of dogs. There's no Cat in Boots. Of,
No, there's no Cat in Boots of dogs.
And when you do fall on dogs, it'll be probably children's books, Scooby-Doo, Santa's Little Helper, Rin-Tin-Tin, Lassie, which are, they're great dogs, but I mean, it has nothing about the gravitas or the something deeper that I felt, related me to my dog. And I thought it's pretty weird. It's actually even worse because when you a dog is basically an insult for many languages.
Right, we'll talk about the Bible.
When you get to philosophers, properly speaking, they all have kind of animal they like wolves for Gilles Deleuze, or I don't know, owls for Hegel. But you'll never see a dog, and you can even read things like from Gilles Deleuze saying that dogs are the shame of the animal kingdom, which is, I mean, that's where the philosophy started, in the sense that I thought there was such discrepancy between the importance of dogs in our lives, and I'm talking about the life of the species we are, because dogs have been around for 50,000 years and have helped us enormously, tremendously. There are lots of scientific literature on dogs. There's been a very interesting renewal of interest in dogs, but how and why they're so important on one side and so invisible on the other, I felt like actually a philosophical problem which needed to be treated as such. And so that's how it started.
Well, it is very interesting. You've said a lot there. I've owned a lot of different kinds of animals. I don't know if "own" is the right word, but I'm going to get in trouble for that.
Word, really.
And so I've had dogs, and I've had cats, and I've had fish, and I've had birds. And I have to say that of all of them, dogs are very different.
It's true. I've had fish, and I have a bird.
Yeah, okay.
And I had a cat, and I agree. I mean, there are things that they all have in common, and what's even more bizarre is that even when you look at a bird scratching his head, you'll feel something common with the bird. You'll scratch your head about approximately the same way. It's very strange, like evolution traits kind of stay the same for centuries and millions of years, but I agree. Dogs are very, very different, and scientists know how to show that difference. They're even very different from apes, which are usually the animals we think are most evolved. I wouldn't say they're more intelligent, because the intelligence of animals is a very complicated topic, and although I'm a philosopher, I read and write philosophy, I'm not a specialist of animal rights or animal philosophy as such, which is a domain in itself. But I've read a lot about it, and there is a special intelligence of dog, which is probably more like something an incredible empathy they have, and way of recognizing what we do, how we do it, where we look. There's this guy who wrote this book, I forgot his name, who says he was studying apes, great apes, and at one point he realized the ape couldn't do something his dog could do very easily without even learning, and he thought dogs can do that, and he wrote a whole book about it. It's very interesting.
I think you're exactly right. I guess the word, having read your book, that and just having heard what you said, it kind of comes down, and this is a sort of a colloquial way of putting it. If I think of all the animals that I've had, only one has been a companion, what I would truly call a companion, and that's the dog. You can't be a companion with a fish. You can't be a companion with a bird. At least I've never managed it. And cats don't care about us.
Well, I would say you could... I think like people who have parrots say that you can be a companion, but I understand what you mean. The way I used to put it is that cats or birds or other species tolerate us. They accept to live with us, but only so far as they tolerate that we live with them. Dogs is very different. Dogs actually make a special bond with us, and they're the only animals in the whole animal kingdom that make a bond with two species, their own and ours, and that's unique.
It seems to me that, as opposed to say fish or birds or something like that, that when you interact with a dog, or at least when I interact with a dog, that it seems to kind of like the interaction. But again, I sort of fear that there's a moment of anthropomorphization here, and in fact, this is just some sort of evolved behavior, and that I am imputing to the dog motives or thoughts that the dog is not having.
Well, it's very difficult, yes, to not anthropomorphize our relation to dogs, but and animals in general. But I think it's true what you're saying. Dogs do like us. I'm surprised by the fact that he's very happy. My dog is very happy. My present dog is very happy when we go out, we do some things that he likes to do. But also when he understands what I mean or what I'm trying to tell him or teach him, and reciprocally when I understand with what he wants. It's like that there's a pleasure of communication, which yes, absolutely, you wouldn't have at all with another kind of animal, I guess. But still, I mean, there's so much going on in animal studies that show that elephants or parrots or even evolved fish understand much more than we understand about ourselves. I put all this in brackets, but there is something very special that's typical to dogs, if I refer to scientific literature again, which it seems that because they have been with us for so long, they have co-evolved with us, and this is very, very, very unique. We actually share a kind of brain together. Our brain 30,000 years ago was relieved of certain functions that were assumed by dogs. Like the vigilance, for instance, mm-hmm. and we created a tandem together, dogs assuming a certain number of things for us, and we could do other things with that with this brain space we had that was freed by the dogs. So in a sense, it is very true that we are. It's not only that dogs are special animal, it's just that we with dogs constitute some kind of hybrid, which is an animal in itself, an animal with two heads or feet and hands, and I mean it's very special. But to come back to philosophy, someone who speaks very well of that is Donna Haraway, because obviously there has been philosophy written about dogs, and her book was a seminal book called the Companion Species Manifesto, where she revealed that she had the dogs, and she loved dogs, and explained why, and one of the reasons why is that she explains that it fits into her theory that we are made of hybrids of nature and culture, and that dogs are really part of us.
Yeah, that makes very good sense to me, and I think that is correct. There is something about the emotional quality that you feel with a dog, its reactivity. It responds to you in a way that seems almost human-like, but it's so ordinarily beneficent that it's almost not human-like, because they seem to just really often really enjoy our company. I want to talk about one thing though, and that is that how dogs essentially got this way. And again, I'm not an expert on evolution, but it seems to me they're the product of what would be called in the biological sciences really hard selection. That is that these traits that we see have essentially been engineered by a kind of Darwinian process where we selected dogs that behaved in this way. Is that borne out by what you know?
Yes, obviously there has been a lot of selection going on with dogs because they pass so many services and they can be trained as guard dogs, as shepherd dogs, and everything. There are lots of competing theories on this actually because it tends to say that we captured wolves and tamed them and selected them to make them nicer to us and kinder and less aggressive, and I'm not sure about this way of seeing things. I rather prefer the idea of the co-evolution thing, which means that we have taken of dogs as much as they've taken of us. There's this new theory I read about, which is fantastic. It's the idea that it's not actually that like demi wolves came and close to human camps and started eating their scraps and they all started living together. But there's this other idea is that humans actually observed how wolves lived. And I'm talking about Homo sapiens. I'm talking about 45,000 years ago. And picked upon their traits of character. Because packs of wolves are actually much more, or were much more evolved socially than human beings at the time. They're very complicated social structures. So I don't know in which direction came the selection, really. There's another amazing book that says that Neanderthals disappeared because they didn't manage to bond with dogs. And that would be one of the reasons why Homo sapiens survived and Neanderthal disappeared. And I think it might be true. I mean, this is incredibly powerful, both the hybrid that we constitute with dog, but also this idea that we espouse their social values as wolves and we imported them in human societies and made these societies better and more efficient. So it really goes both ways.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I just have to mention, because it's always sort of blown my mind, is the morphological diversity of dogs as opposed to, and I'm sure I'm going to get in trouble for this, but almost any other species, because dogs are all one species. They are just dogs and they can all interbreed. That includes a Doberman Pinscher and your little lap dog. And the thing about it is, like, if you look at morphological diversity in humans, it's extraordinarily limited. I mean, sure, there's some 7-footers out there and there's some short people and, you know, they come in different shapes and sizes, but dogs, it's just truly astounding, the morphological kind of plasticity of the dog, understructure. I don't know what the word is for this in evolution, but it seems to have the ability to morph in ways that, yeah, it's incredible.
Phenotype.
I mean, I never
thought about it. Actually, I have to agree. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah, although there's something which is it is really their phenotype in the sense that what strikes me is the reverse, in the sense that dogs don't seem to be very sensitive to this between them. I mean, they will. I mean, my dog will bark at a bigger dog or maybe get scared of a smaller dog, and he has different reactions towards dogs and their sizes, but it's very difficult to know why, how, when. I mean, other times he will just have lots of fun with an enormous dog, and it just seemed to be totally indifferent to this diversity. Well, that's why you also find interbreed dogs made of poodles and Weimaraner.
It's an astounding thing.
I would love to have a biologist come on to
the show and explain exactly how this can be. Because if you look at morphological diversity in most species, I could be totally wrong, but I've not seen anything that approaches, that's in my own personal experience, dogs. Not even cats, because cats essentially come in one size. Mm. I'll get in trouble for that too, but they essentially come in one size. And but
well, they're creating these dog cats like the Maine Coon, which are huge. But
the diversity of dogs is it's kind of an amazing thing. At least it strikes me as an astounding evolutionary fact, and I can't really explain it. So if you're a biologist, please come onto the show and explain it to me. I wanted to talk a little bit about the image of dogs. And as you point out, there is, I'd never thought about it, but there really is no, they don't generally have a terribly positive image in at least the Western canon. That's the only one I know. I mean, I can think of one good story about a dog, and that's when a dog dies. And that's essentially when Odysseus comes home.
That's it.
And I forget the dog's name, but it just lays down and lays down and dies. That's its big moment. So can you talk a little bit about the image of dogs in the Western canon in generally?
Well, there's one thing we could say, which would actually be more than Western, it would be universal, and it's a very simple example we can comes to mind, which is the fact that no country in the world has a dog for emblem.
Is that true? That's right. Yeah,
You know, the Americans have the bald eagle, and then the English have lions, although lions probably never put their feet on the ground of England, and the Russians will have the bear, but absolutely no country has a dog for emblem, which is fascinating when you come to think of it again, because dogs have been around for so long and pay so many services and so essential to our life, and we love them so much. If we stick to the Western canon, we can see also that there are not dogs in the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, that the apostles have all animals as symbols, but no dog. And it's you really have to go back to antiquity to find dogs figured and actually worshipped. That's a huge difference with our culture today. Because if you go back to ancient Greece, you'll find Cerberus who keeps the gates of hell. But you also find Anubis in ancient Egypt. Same thing. He keeps the gates of hell or passes the souls of the dead to Osiris. And you'll find this in Maya culture with Xolotl, who's also the kind of servant god of death. You'll find this in Indian culture with Kalabhairava, who is a dog who's the god of death and has got a dog along his side. You'll find this, you know, this thing is a universal trait that both dogs have kind of been invisibilized, if you let me invent this word, and also when they are present, it is as the gods of the shadows, and that's very interesting because yet again it forces us to exercise our mind on something which could be a deeper meaning of what dogs are to us.
Do you care to speculate on why that is the case? I mean, I could speculate a little bit. I mean, I suppose you could say, well, dogs were disease carriers. There were often wild dogs around. Some of them share a kinship with wolves, and they'll eat you. So there are reasons to dislike dogs, but they've always been kept.
I think there are two main reasons for this. The first one is that dogs are actually difficult to represent, to figure out, because they're intermediate animals. They have a part of themselves is into nature, and another one is with us. They're hybrids, as I was saying, and this is actually the meaning, I think, of the they're worshipping as gods of death, because what they do is that they are between life and death. They are the gods of thresholds, and they are between night and day. Like Xolotl, the Mayan god, is also the god of that brings the sun into the abyss, and they're messengers in that sense. And it's very difficult. That thresholds is something that are very difficult to represent, in generally speaking. because we don't know where to put them. They're not on one side. That's why I like to say that their dogs are dialectical animals, and I'm always a bit. I love Hegel, but I feel sorry that he didn't understand that dogs were his philosophical animal much more than the owl, because really they are these dialectical beings that bring together opposites. So that's one thing, and the other is probably more has more to do with the unconscious, with repressed feelings and desires, because every time you encounter something or someone that is both a totem and a taboo, worshipped and made a disgusting thing at the same time, you have to deal with powerful, deeper things which are in our own shadows, and this I think has something to do with their submissiveness, which is something which makes us very uneasy. That's another concept that we have lots of difficulty dealing with, and mainly because, as Freud has told us, masculinity, which has permeated our cultures and our civilizations for millennials, has to repress submissiveness, and it has to repress the strange pleasure that we can take in submissiveness when we are children. And dogs seem to express and to show off this pleasure of submissiveness in a very, very peculiar way, which I think makes us both proud of having dogs because we feel we're mastering these powerful animals, and also ashamed if I take the word of Deleuze, the shame of the natural kingdom, because we're so close to dogs, we would like them to be like us and to refuse submissiveness and to be free and to show their own will of power, and they don't. They don't. They enjoy this state. I think we're faced with our own contradictions and our own repressed desires. And that's why I think it's so important, actually, to have a dog, because it means we have to face and go and delve into our own inner darkness and make peace and with our own desires.
One of the things I want to come back to submissiveness in a second, because I'd never thought of that. That's a very, very good point. But one of the things that you reminded me of when you were speaking is philosophers who think a lot about robots, and there are such, they talk about this uncanny valley. That is, if you have a robot that just looks like a robot, you're comfortable with it. But if you have a robot that looks quite like a human, but isn't quite a human, that's very disturbing. People are very off-put by this. There have been experiments and things. They don't feel comfortable with it. And dogs kind of occupy that space because there's something very kindred about them, something very human about them, but they're not human. They act in that way, but it's a little bit disturbing in a way because they're so much like us.
Yeah,
but they're not us.
That's very true. I love the uncanny valley concept. It's great, and you're absolutely right. And actually, Donna Haraway wrote on cyborgs, and I don't think she has ever mentioned the link between cyborgs and dogs in that sense. But you're right, and the sole word of shame is so specific to us. I mean, we only have shame and feel shame for another human. We don't feel shame for birds or if we see elephants copulating, we won't feel shame. But we feel shame if dogs do it. So that really goes to show how much we do identify with them. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I hate to mention this because we had a lot of dogs on Instagram, but occasionally a dog will hump your leg.
Absolutely. You know,
and there's something so disturbing about that. I don't even know where to start, but like everybody just looks around like, no.
Well, you know, I mean, people on Instagram even have invented ways of hiding their modesty, you know, it's crazy. It's ridiculous, but yes, it is because we share this common destiny between dogs and us. They do absolutely represent and lots of things we fantasize about.
And in a sense, you know, I come from a place, and culture is probably too high-minded a word for it, but from a place in the United States where we had working dogs and we hunted them. They were largely pointers, but we had Weimaraners as well. And there's a beautiful Weimaraner. In fact, this Weimaraner on the cover of your book keeps staring at me. I got to turn it over because it's bothering me. And the thing about it is, we kind of had one thing I noticed when I was young is that we had to make an effort to treat those dogs sternly and cruelly because they were working dogs. But it was an effort. Like it was something that men did. Let me put it that way. That the men that I grew up with who went hunting with me, they made an effort just to say, that's just a dog. It's nothing more. It's just a working dog. But this was hard. It was hard for me, and I think it was hard for them. And, you know, sometimes they'd have to be put down, and if they behaved badly, if they bit somebody where I grew up, if a dog bit you, that dog was dead. It was not going to get a second chance. But I do remember the effort, the emotional effort that it took to deal with dogs as dogs, I guess I would say. If that's a little bit that's a conflation or equivocation, but you get my point.
Yeah. I also imagine that people who do work with dogs might find our conversation a bit preposterous, or at least we shouldn't. We shouldn't be overthinking dogs, because dogs are just dogs, as you just said. And maybe it's something to do with the fact that our dogs are not working dogs anymore. They're lab dogs. Our dogs have been the story of the dogs in our contemporary habitats is pretty new, and it relates to the fact that people who used to have dogs and had to move in cities around the 18th century missed their animals, and the ones they could have with them were dogs and then cats, and that's how the new dog, the contemporary dog, which is not the working dog anymore, appeared, and it's obvious that we've created new types of relationships with our dogs, but that might not have been the case when people used to only work with dogs. But then we have also created new relationships with our children. You know, when you read about Rousseau, who left his seven children in the street.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what are we talking about? Dogs? I mean,
I teach Rousseau, and that's something I often bring up. Is like that we just don't do that anymore. He didn't have any problem with it at all. I was like, yeah, sure, I just did this.
But then, I mean, even in older literature you find on dogs, or the sentiment for dogs has always been very strong. I mean, I love this anecdote about Martin Luther, who's such a severe theologian about everything, and who wanted to, you know, who was ready to go to fight for any kind of article of faith, a minor article of faith, and he was totally different with his dog. I think one of his children had a dog, and. And the child asked Martin Luther if his dog was going to go to paradise. So, and Martin Luther has said yes, and his little golden wag tail will be wagging over there as well. Can you imagine? I mean, the ogre of Reformation being this little
old... Yeah, well, I'm a Lutheran. I was raised a Lutheran, and he knew very well, better than I do, that's false. That according to
I don't know how the church relates to this today, but I know it's a question that lots of people ask about their dogs, and they don't see why they shouldn't.
But, I know what you mean. Yeah, no, because it makes sense. They're so much like us. They should go.
That,
yeah.
that even in the 16th century, that was already a sentiment for dogs. You'll find dogs like this in Albrecht Dürer's paintings. Dogs are associated with melancholy. And they're there. You can feel that he loves dogs totally. And even a hunter like Gaston Phoebus, a very famous lord, French lord, who had lots of dogs, wrote one of the first book on dogs, says it's a beautiful, very touching piece of the book. He says dogs have all the qualities in the world, except they last they don't last long. And it tells a lot about, what you were saying, even if you have to be hard with dogs, when you put them down, there is something happens even to the hardest people. Okay.
Okay. So one of the interesting things that I noticed while you were talking is that that we give over these urban spaces to dogs in places like New York and London. And is that true in Paris? Do they have dog parks in Paris?
Absolutely not.
They don't.
No, it's very upside down here. You will be able to eat with your dog at a restaurant.
Really?
Yeah, even have him at your table, basically. I mean, if it's a lap
dog. You can bring your dog to a table. You've got to be kidding me. Is that really? That's astounding.
But then you can't take him in a park. It's totally absurd. I mean... The difference between Anglo-Saxon culture and French culture regarding animals, in generally speaking, is obviously fascinating.
So wait, just let me get this right. I've got to ask this. So you can actually take a dog into a restaurant?
Oh yeah, any restaurant.
That's wild. Yeah, I did not know that. Well, you know, I know a lot of people in Koreans and Chinese people, and to them, some of the ones that I know, the idea of having a dog inside, that is where you live, is it's haram. It's not kosher.
Right.
It's, you can't do that. Yeah. And when I tell them that it's okay to have a dog inside in the United States, they just don't quite get that. Like how that could possibly be. It's a little bit, to give an analogy, it's a little bit like I told these Chinese students I was teaching once that in America, you can walk into somebody's house with your shoes on.
Right.
And they didn't believe me. because they had just come from China and like, nah, come on, stop it. That's really not true, is it? I mean, you know, it's really true. You can walk into an American's house and leave your shoes on most of the time. And they were absolutely astounded by this. I wanted to talk about why dogs have such a bad reputation. Because we have this expression in English, as you know, you're a dog. It's not so, you know, to call someone a dog is not a good thing. It's a very bad thing. And in many cultures and religions, being called a dog is an extraordinarily bad thing. Can you speculate a little bit on that?
I would link it to the conversation we had on submissiveness. I think it's really something about this, the fact that our civilizations have been constructed on the false premise that anything which is masculine is good, and anything which is and all these values associated with masculinity, which is activity, power, freedom, are to be valued, and that any kind of animal or person or obviously another sex than masculine should be impure and furthermore repressed, and I think that's just the story of civilizations, how they've been for centuries and even more than for thousands of years. We're just coming out of this. This has been 100 years only that we've been coming out of this that stereotype, and obviously you see that when Trump says dying like a dog, or his opponents are dogs, or women are dogs, or bitches, you see that kind of archaic power play of the would-be strongman treating dogs that way so badly, but it's really the end of that. I think the liberation movements, emancipation movements, of women, of animal rights, and now even, I mean, dogs, who even inside the animal right movement had a very special place because, you know, even activists didn't know what to do with dogs. Is dramatically changing for the best, and I think we'll have, I'm sure we'll deal less and less with this. It's over.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you because, you know, one of the things that I just noticed in the U.S. news that cruelty to animals became a federal crime in the United States just very recently, like in the last couple of days. And again, where I grew up, cruel to the animal, I mean, it was a thing. I mean, you weren't supposed to be cruel to animals, but the idea that there would be federal legislation, that was not something on my radar when I was growing up. Not to say I was cruel to animals. I wasn't cruel to animals. I loved them and took care of them. But, you know, that is a definite change in attitude toward the animal kingdom, and particularly, I think, toward dogs and cats. Yeah,
and it's a very, very deep and slow to happen because it's so encrusted in our culture. I mean, there are two things, particularly, well, in France in particular, the idea that animals are machines relates to Descartes and 16th century thought. And that's probably why there's so little space for animals in the city in France. They're still, in a sense, machines. And as you said, germ vectors and stuff. And then in the Anglo-Saxon culture or in the general Western culture, there's this idea that we forget that was taught in the Bible, which is that the whole of nature is fallen from grace, and that nature as a whole has no meaning. It's just dead, and it's just there to be used by human beings, and particularly men. We tend to forget because the church doesn't like to talk too much of that, and it's trying to take an ecological turn. But it's very, very difficult for Christian civil cultures to make this turn because it's just not what we were told for 2,000 years.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I had never really thought about it in that way, that it was the submissiveness of dogs that was really being dismissed, and in kind of an offhanded way, too. It's never direct. Nobody ever says, "You're a dog because you're submissive." they just say you're a dog, and the rest is kind of implied.
What really is meant is you're a dog because you're taking pleasure in things that I am not authorized to take pleasure in.
Yeah, well put. Yeah, right. That's very well put.
And I'm jealous.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So, do you have any particular thoughts on the animal rights movement or anything like this? I haven't thought about it at all, really, because, like I say, I keep fish and I have some birds, and so I don't really identify with them very much. So,
well, that wasn't the main point of the book.
Oh no, not at all.
Really,
yeah, I was just
dive into animal rights,
yeah, no.
Which is a very, very complicated and developing topic, and obviously, I just my limits with animal rights would be that they shouldn't authorize to belittle human rights. sometimes you're not quite sure. I mean, loving animals is something, and I think loving humans is something else. And still, and my the metaphor I tend to use to explain the difference that you can still make between animals and human beings is the same as you can make between liquid water and solid water. I mean, we are made of the same molecules,
yeah,
as solid water and liquid water are made of. But if you take a kilo of solid water on your feet, it'll probably be broken.
Yeah.
Which will not be the case if it's a liter of liquid water. And that makes a difference. I mean, there are differences. There we have differences in our brains. Our prefrontal cortex has developed very differently, and in part thanks to dogs. because dogs have taken on them to as I was saying, to develop functions in their brains that could liberate space for our prefrontal cortex to evolve and take the remaining space. So it is their sacrifice is fundamental to the development of the human species as we know it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. That's great. We've taken up a lot of your time. Before I let you go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I am actually working on climate change, which is okay. Kind of the follow. I mean, there's some logic in all this. Yeah, I've written a little book called Carbofascism, What It Is and How to Fight It.
Well, we'll have to have you on the network when that's done. I hope you stay in touch. Let me tell everybody that's been listening to this interview that we've been talking to Mark Alizard about his book, Dogs. It's out from Polity Press. I encourage you to buy it. It has many, many great virtues. One of them is, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, is that it's short and pithy. I like short and pithy books. Having written some long and turgid ones, I don't really recommend them. But this one, you can actually sit down and read. And so that's a great virtue for a book. So, Mark, let me say thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Marshall.
Absolutely my pleasure.